Follow On Podcast here on followoncricket.com. Chinmay Vaidyapart Joshi, Akshay Chavan, and Anish Tal joining me, guys. We just witnessed England close out a 1-0 test series win over Pakistan. They played three tests, only got a result in one, and I think weather probably actually won two of those test matches. So it was weather 2, England 1, Pakistan 0 in that one. But we'll start with some big news around cricket. The World Cups for the next 2 years that were originally scheduled to be in 2020 and 2021 have been pushed back. The 2021 T20 World Cup, which was scheduled to be in India, will still take place in India. The 2021 Women's One Day World Cup, which was scheduled to take place in New Zealand, will be now moved to 2022. And the 2020 World Cup, which was supposed to take place in Australia this October, has now been pushed back to 2022. Now, the skeptics will wonder why the one event that was in India has not been pushed back despite some of the coronavirus numbers. You guys have anything to say on that? Pure coincidence? Or is there a little something going on behind the scenes?
I'm going to go with pure coincidence with a straight face. Yeah. I mean, I think we all know who has the most power in cricket today, who controls most of the money. And yeah, I'll go with Anish on this one.
India stayed in the news. Suresh Raina and MS Dhoni both announced their retirement on the same day from international cricket. They'll both continue to play for Chennai Super Kings. And the possibility that now exists for them in other T20 leagues around the world now that they are no longer under the BCCI's control. But we'll start with the retirements themselves. One memory that you have from each player, one moment that you remember from each player, or them collectively, that you think kind of stands out for that player's career or those two players over the span of their careers.
Yes, for me, I guess we can start with Suresh Raina. For me, the big one was, I believe it was 2010 World Cup, where he scored the third ever T20 century. I think that really cemented him as one of the top T20 batsmen in the world at that time. And we all know how much success he had in the international game and even at Chennai in the IPL in T20s. So for me, that was a huge jumpstart to his career that really cemented him as a solid top order batsman in the limited over format. And then, of course, for me, another thing, the fielding, right? I don't know if you guys recall, but there was one particular match against New Zealand where he took a left-handed diving almost completely horizontal to the ground at point. And so we all know he's a great catcher, has tremendous hands, plucks a lot of stuff out of the air. So for me, those are the two big moments for me, and that's what I'll remember Suresh Raina by.
That was a really great innings, and definitely his fielding is one of the highlights of his career. I will remember him most. I feel like he had one of the prettiest front foot cover drives, just seeing him present the full face of the bat. He hit some absolutely beautiful strokes to the offside. I think his leg side game always got a little bit of criticism, especially the shorter deliveries, but anything full and off, and that thing was headed straight to the boundary. I think one of the innings I remember is from a 2016 tour in Australia. It was actually the last T20. India had already won the first two, and Australia were batting first, and Shane Watson had put in a blinder of 124. This is back when Cameron Bancroft was actually keeping for Australia, so it was a bit of a, maybe not their first top team, but Sharma and Shikhar and Virat Kohli had given India a good foundation, but Suresh Raina finished off the innings with a 49 off of 25 to chase 200. And, you know, this was also in 2016, you know, chasing 200 now I feel like almost is the norm, but back then I feel like that was still an even more monumental accomplishment, and that was one of his legacies, was him and Dhoni being finishers at the end of innings for India.
My two memories were in the 2011 ODI World Cup in India, and these two innings were, well, first of all, let me start. I think Suresh Raina is probably one of the best Indian lefty batsmen I've seen, but the two best memories or innings I have of Raina are back-to-back games in 2011. 34 not out versus Australia. He had a really good finishing partnership with Yuvraj. I know it's only 34 runs, but he scored it off like 26 balls or something. And he was kind of the anchor for that last partnership. And then I think more importantly, 36 not out against Pakistan in Mohali in the semifinal. And I could almost say that without these two innings, India might not have even played in the final, because 36th against Pakistan. It was for the ninth wicket. It was the last partnership. And Saraina batted with a tail, literally the last batsman, to get that 36 and seal the game and give India a place in the finals. So I would say those key innings, which showed how clutch he was, how calm he was while guiding the team to the World Cup final, I would say those two.
I think you mentioned that semifinal against Pakistan. That was, I think, that's probably his best innings that he played, given the circumstance of what that match meant for India and for him specifically, because if you recall, you know, he didn't play in the group stage of that World Cup. And I think that was a little more calculated than what people will believe. But obviously he had the confidence from that Australia match to then carry over into the semifinal against Pakistan. And you're right, he did bat with the tail. And India was in the 230s when Raina kind of turned things on, and they ended up at 260, which proved to be a better than par score on that surface, and they were able to defend that. So I have to go with that one for my memory for Suresh Raina. I think these two players, and we can share our Dhoni memories, but I think these two players are so connected based on their development together and sort of Raina's promotion to the ODI squad and then the T20 squad under Dhoni, and their success at Chennai. They're so linked, and I think it was fitting for them to both announce their retirement on the same day. For me, for MS Dhoni, obviously the 2011 final is something that everyone will remember, but for me, I think his best performance as a captain was the 2013 Champions Trophy, where they won at the end against England in a rain-shortened match. But the reason I say that wasn't necessarily because of the individual performances or the tactics. It was kind of Dhoni doing it for the first time with a team that was largely chosen by him. In the T20 World Cup in 2007, that there were a lot of holdovers from India's A team. There were some youngsters in there, but you know, there was still Yuvraj, there was still Sehwag in there. So there was still some guys that were sort of holdovers from the older generation. The 2011 World Cup, pretty much the same thing, right? Tendulkar, Sehwag, Gambhir, Zaheer Khan, Harbhajan. I mean, that's all from the older generation. But the 2013 Champions Trophy was very different. It was Rohit Sharma, Shikhar Dhawan, Virat Kohli, Suresh Raina, Ravi Ashwin, Bhuvneshwar Kumar, Ravindra Jadeja. Those are all guys that Dhoni kind of promoted and brought into the squad. So for me, I know 2011 is huge, but I think the 2013 Champions Trophy was kind of Dhoni's masterpiece as a captain. So I think for me, that's the best memory that I have.
I was surprised Raina retired. He was only 33, and he still was one of the gun fielders on the team, and I would say like a leadership presence there. But yeah, that kind of came as a shock to me. I mean, I know the situation has changed with COVID and everything, and obviously, he's still going to be in IPL, but I was kind of surprised he retired from internationals.
Yeah, well, I don't think he was getting too many games, unfortunately, at this point. I think he was being, there are a lot of other younger players who are being selected over him at this point in his career, and I think it was time for him to say, I don't think I'm in the international side, and it's time for me to step away and let the youth actually come up. So I think it was a calculated decision. He probably is on the younger side, but obviously not at the caliber that Dhoni is. So
yeah,
so for me, I was just going to continue on with MS Dhoni. Yeah, Chinmay, like you said, I think, you know, 2011 World Cup, that final, that's something that's just going to be ingrained in everyone's head forever. That six to end the match is huge for India. So that's definitely the moment for me. But other than that, the other thing that really stands out to me, I'm going to call out a little fun thing that Dhoni likes to do, is the flip between the legs when he's at the stumps for runouts. I love seeing that, right? No one else has done that. He's the one to invent that, where he just catches the ball. If the throw is off, it's not really right over the stumps, and just flips it behind his back or in between his legs or something and gets runouts that way. And that was extremely innovative. No one's ever done that before, and I'll always remember those.
The helicopter is another one. I know he didn't
invent it, but
we kind of perfected it. And I would obviously say one key moment, obviously no one's debating his clutchness, but this really drove it home, was against that Bangladesh team, when maybe this was more due to Bangladesh's lack of experience or clutching or whatever you want to call it. But Dhoni was aware enough. He was keeping one glove in that last over. Bangladesh missed, and they went for the run. when he dove towards the stumps, just went horizontal and just knocked the stump out before the last record could make it. And that was just like that presence of mind right there for me.
Yeah, I think that his wicketkeeping is definitely stands out as one of his key skills, and especially the way he kept and just made it look fun out there. And being a leader behind the stumps, it was always intimidating to play India under his captaincy. I was going to, you know, all the innings and memories you brought up, I certainly agree with. One other thing I wanted to bring up with his batting, I don't know if we're ever going to see a man who could, he had the strongest wrists I feel like I've ever seen. Those whips on those full balls over long on, over mid wicket, just unbelievable. I don't think I've seen another player hit shots like that. That's something I'm never going to forget for him. In terms of innings, I am going to give a throwback to 2005, soon after he scored his first ODI century. This was in a series against Sri Lanka. It was actually a 7 ODI series back when that was a thing, believe it or not. He was batting number 3 as well at that time, something we didn't see for most of his career. But he scored he came in early after Sachin Tendulkar got out for 2, and he put up 183 off of 145 balls to lead India to a chase of 300, which again, the magnitude of a chase of 300 in 2005 is infinitely higher than chasing 300 today. So that was the innings that stuck out to me.
I think back in the day, 300 was almost unfathomable. Now 300 is fairly routine, but yeah, I think everyone covered it pretty well. The innovation, the ability to plan 2 steps ahead in every single situation, the ability to elevate the team in all formats. And I think also the ability to progress in each format of the game. I think Dhoni was maybe the first one to see that each format required a different type of player, even though generally you could keep the same team. And I think he really started to tweak around the edges of a core team for each format, which has made India so successful in all 3 formats of the game. I'll shift gears here now. You guys mentioned Raina, only 33, Dhoni a little bit older at 39. There's speculation now that we will see these players featured in other T20 leagues around the world now that they're not controlled by the BCCI. Do you guys think MS Dhoni and Suresh Raina will be in other leagues once they kick back off?
I think certainly, obviously IPL, but what's like the next tier? I would say like Big Bash, right? So I could see Raina going to Big Bash. I'm not so sure about Dhoni. I know Dhoni probably still has a couple more years of IPL left in him. Maybe he'll just rest up year round for that. Not so sure about him, but definitely could see Raina in the Big Bash, maybe even CPL.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on behind the scenes with these guys. I know Dhoni's also been involved with the military, so God knows what his commitments are like with that.
I think he's done with that. I think that was just a 1-month stint to kind of take a break from everything. I don't think he's heavily involved in that. I think if the offers come through, again, this is a big if, but if the offers come through and they're, you know, serious enough, I think he'll consider them.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, you're looking at the captain of India for, you know, over 10 years now, and regardless of the fact that he's no longer controlled by the BCCI, MS Dhoni still has, you know, a long-standing relationship with the BCCI, and it's a very tricky situation. I don't know if he'll actually go to play in these leagues. We know from a financial standpoint, there's really no reason for him to go to any of these leagues, right? Based on his sponsorships and how much he makes in the IPL, the Big Bash and the Caribbean Premier League are pretty much chump change at this point, unfortunately. So there's not a lot going for him on that standpoint either. So I have a hard time seeing why Dhoni would show up in any of those leagues, just given the circumstances. Would I want him to be in one of those leagues? Of course. I think that would be extremely exciting, generate a lot of revenue for those smaller leagues. But I don't see it happening. And Ashay said Raina has a better chance, which I think he's absolutely right about. But even for him, I'm really not sure, just based on the same factors. But of course, he's less of a man than Dhoni is in terms of his cricket history.
Obviously, Dhoni is the first choice if any teams would want to have one of those 2 players. But I think Raina would be a pretty solid get. We'll have to wait and see if either of those players takes a run at the Big Bash, which would be after the IPL, or maybe even the Pakistan Super League. Don't bank on that one, or maybe the Caribbean Premier League, which would be probably the next best league after those. But those two, Raina and Tony, out of international cricket, they will feature in the IPL, which this year is in the UAE. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll discuss England's Test Series win over Pakistan. You're listening to the Follow On podcast here on followoncricket.com. Back into the Follow On podcast here on followoncricket.com. You can check us out on Facebook at the Follow On. Follow us on Twitter at the Follow On. As always, all of our content at followoncricket.com. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. We're talking about England's Test Series victory over Pakistan. The official scorecard was England 1, Pakistan 0. The unofficial scorecard was the weather 2, England 1, Pakistan 0. We have to do something about weather conditions ruining test matches, cricket matches in general. There was speculation of changing the conditions for bad light to account for the umpires calling for bad light. There was even talk about putting domes on stadiums. I'm not sure what the exact solution is practically, but I know that something has to be done. I think too many matches in general are being lost to weather conditions. It's 2020. We have to figure something out by now. I mean, I understand weather's part of the game. And I understand that, you know, in this case, Pakistan had almost no chance. And the weather kind of saved them and allowed them to kind of pull a Houdini in the third test. But I'm tired of losing cricket to bad light, which is very arbitrary, in my opinion, and rain. So I'm not sure what your guys' thoughts on how cricket can combat these conditions, but I think domes may not be practical across the world, but maybe in England they can look and see if they can do domes on stadiums, because baseball does it and it seems to work fine for baseball. So I think domes and stadiums could be something that cricket should look for in the future.
I think the biggest equivalent we see here in the States is like not necessarily domes, but stadiums with retractable roofs. And so I feel like those are more multi-purpose. I guess the bigger thing is it depends on the size of what is the size of a cricket stadium compared to a baseball stadium. And I think the cricket stadiums in general are much bigger. So probably a more costly venture. Thought I had in mind was, could we have like a reserve day for test matches? Like, you know, if at least 90 overs are lost due to weather in the first 5 days, then you play a six day weather permitting. Now, I know this is, I'd love to see this, but we also see in World Cup tournaments where teams will even get a reserve day to play like a semifinal match. So I don't have much faith in the ICC to make that happen.
Yeah, I completely agree with you though, Anish. We have to have a reserve day. I think the biggest issue right now, of course, the weather is huge and planning is very bad. But the idea of not getting a result from a match that lasts 5 days to new fans, even to older fans now, and definitely to fans who are just picking up the game, is just crazy, right? It's absolutely absurd to not get a result after 5 days, and that's straining away a lot of fans. So there have to be results from these matches. And I know, you know, the ICC is doing a great job of pushing the World Test Championship. You know, test ratings are up than they were 2 years ago, so that's great. But there has to be changes to the game, and although there are a lot of traditionalists who want things to stay the same way, cricket's going to lose viewership, test viewership, if this doesn't change.
Yeah, I agree with you guys. I think the bad light issue is something that can definitely be more easily solved. Just put floodlights in the ground. It's that simple. I mean, there's really no excuse other than that.
There is no excuse whatsoever to not have good lights. That is easy. And, you know, the Rose Bowl Stadium actually has floodlights. They just, I guess, they're not strong enough. And to me, that's insane. How do you install floodlights that are not good enough at the darkest? You think you would get floodlights that work when it's pitch black outside. That's why you get them in the first place.
Then you need to play with a pink wall, and a lot of the old dudes who are so adamant about keeping tests so pure are against that. I know they've been playing with pink balls more and more, but I don't know why they're so against it.
Yeah, I think the desire to get a result is more important than the color of the ball. I think that's more important. The weather is, again, a little harder to control. They do have to account for rain and domes, and retractable roofs are a good idea. I think, again, the cost of it being feasible for every country in the world to kind of look into that. Reserve days are the easiest solution because you can bank that into every schedule. But there's no excuse for bad light, in my opinion. That's just inexcusable. And it's a tired, you know, kind of crutch that just needs to go from the game, because it's very simple. Just turn on a floodlight. We'll talk about the actual cricket now, and we'll start with England. England won the series 1-0. Probably should have been 2-0 based on the third test and how the match went. But we'll start with England's openers, because we gave them some significant praise in the previous podcast for their performance against the West Indies, but they did not perform so well, Rory Burns and Dom Sibley, in this three-test set.
Yeah, pretty disappointing from both of them as a pair. Dom Sibley made a few starts. Rory Burns had absolutely no impact on the series whatsoever. Again, like we had discussed on the last podcast, like, you know, they played really well against the West Indies, but they need to show up against a team with more challenging bowlers, and they simply didn't. So, you know, I feel like we're almost back to square one at this point.
Yeah, definitely agreed. I think Sibley, to me, looked a lot better than Burns. I think, like you said, Anish, he got off to some starts. You know, he just looked better at the crease. He looked more confident. He was middling more balls. Burns just looked lost this entire series. And he never got off to a start. And yeah, I think, unfortunately, he's got to get cycled for the next test series, because in this day and age, you just can't have an entire test series where you don't score as an opening batsman. And so I don't know about Sibley. I liked what he came up with. I don't know what other options England have. I know they have more attacking batsmen there, and some people will argue that, but there's a lot of cases to not have that. They've struggled when they have attacking opening batsmen at the top of their test order. So for me, if the next test series starts tomorrow, I'm giving Sibley the nod and I'm taking Burns out.
Burns also got exposed this series by Shahin Afridi, the left-arm pace, which he didn't face against West Indies.
Yep, absolutely.
I was looking at... I feel like since we've started podcasting, England have been kind of messing with their top three, or their openers, and maybe, I think, yeah, like you said, I think their left-arm pace really exposed them, and these are bowler-friendly conditions, nothing that England's not used to. I think if they're going to go with these openers, I think they should keep experimenting. Sibley showed some more promise. Zach Crawley was another good one at the top of the order. You don't know if he's a flash in the pan, but from based on what we saw in his 250, he looked really technically sound, and he was timing the ball well. And I think that innings was one of the better ones I've seen in the past couple of years.
Ashay, you mentioned Zach Crawley. We'll go to him now, that double hundred, which kind of showcased his potential. You know, he's in his early 20s, so still a long way to go for him, and he's getting this exposure now. I think England have shown more desire to play younger players earlier in their careers. We're seeing it after the World Cup. They included a lot of young players in their tour of New Zealand, and now we're seeing it again against Ireland in the ODIs. They played a lot of younger players or their backup players to their first team. And now we're seeing Zach Crawley get a chance. Maybe it was because Ben Stokes was out, but Crawley made the most of his opportunity. You think he can develop into something bigger based on what you saw in that 250?
Absolutely. I loved to watch him bat this series. And he only played the last game of this series. He played the last two tests. He only had two innings total, though, because England batted once in both of those matches. He scored 50 in the first one, and of course the big 267 in the second one. And, you know, just watching him, he's extremely technically sound, plays compact, he's got good height, he times the ball really well, he was hitting shots all over the park. And, you know, he was extremely confident. He was walking out to Mohammad Abbas and Nasim Shah, people who have, you know, two bowlers who have a lot of pace and can move the ball, and were troubling a lot of the other England batsmen, and treated them as if they were beeline bowlers. So it was extremely impressive to watch, and I think he's growing in confidence just over those two innings. And like you said, Chinmay, he's 22 years old, so a lot of upside here, and he looks like the future of English cricket. I know I'm getting extremely hyped over two innings, but there were two long innings, and I got to watch him bat close to 450 deliveries. Well, I didn't watch all 450, but he faced that many, so it's a great start.
There's nothing else to get hyped about. You might as well get hyped about that.
Well, speaking of getting hyped, I think the person that is the most hyped about this is the guy batting below him, Joe Root. He finally is able to bat in his coveted number four spot.
Yep, that is huge, right? He had to bat at three for a big part of this series just because they didn't have anyone to bat at three. It just didn't make sense to put someone else there because they thought they, you know, the rest of their batting lineup just couldn't face the new ball, and it was better to just put Joe Root out there instead of another sitting duck. So, yeah, that's huge for the English lineup, and I think people underestimate how much value that has to let Joe Root go bat at four now.
Another thing you had mentioned, Parth, about Zach Crawley was his, he's a bit of a taller guy, and, you know, he was right in there, again, facing the new ball because the openers weren't doing much. And having some height and good technical skills is a huge asset because that gives you a little more room to work when bowlers are bowling short balls, and it makes it tougher for bowlers to aim those short balls when they've got a taller guy to aim at. So, yeah, he's got some upside. Let's see what he can do when he gets some more playing time.
Yeah, and it needs just to tack on one extra thing while we're on the hype train here. You said, you know, with his height, he's able to get back, get on top of the ball, and pull, and cut, and, you know, drive off the back foot extremely well. But he's able to come on the front foot extremely well, too, and he has a huge stride forward and is able to drive bowlers back. If they're, you know, even a touch full, he was hitting, you know, 145K balls straight back at the bowler, you know, just like we see Virat Kohli and the best batsman in the world do to the best bowlers. So, yeah, he's got it all, and we saw it on show.
I think the best thing for Zach Crawley going forward is that he's going to get ample time with guys like Joe Root, Jason Roy, Joss Butler, Owen Morgan even, Ben Stokes, some of the best batsmen around. And he's going to pick up little things from each of them while he's still relatively young. So I think the future is obviously very bright for him. And this inning showed that he already has a lot of skills, but I'm excited to see what else he can pick up from all these great players that he's going to be playing around going forward. I mentioned Joss Butler there, and we'll go to him now. We were debating his place in the team, and it wasn't just us. It was a lot of people around the world who were debating whether Joss Butler should be in England's test side. We kind of settled on the wicketkeeper debate and whether he was in there for his keeping skills, which obviously he showcased in this test series. But with the bat, he was phenomenal. And in that first test, he was in the winning partnership up until kind of the very end. He got out at the very end, but England had already, you know, wrapped up the game by that point. I think Joss Butler, you know, I don't know if I would say he saved his test career because it looked like he had already done that in the final test match against the West Indies, but he definitely kind of cemented himself as England's wicketkeeper in test matches with the bat in this series.
Yeah, I don't know. Definitely with the bat, Chinmay, I agree with you there. I mean, there's no arguing that he's probably, of all of the keeper batsmen in test cricket today, he's the most useful batsman for sure. But there were a lot of holes in his keeping game, right? The match that he scored, I believe that was the first match where he scored 75 to win the game. He also dropped three catches. And I think you could make a pretty strong argument to say that if he didn't drop three catches, he didn't even have to score those 75 runs in order for England to win that match. So I think the importance of taking every opportunity behind the wickets in test matches especially is so important that sometimes you really have to weigh how many runs you score and how important it is to take catches. Yeah, so yeah, that would be my argument. And I'm not saying that that means that Joss Butler should be out of the team, because I think he brings an extremely good dynamic and, you know, a lot of hype to that squad. But yeah, I don't know. The argument could be made that if England can find a true keeper who is really good behind the stumps and doesn't drop any catches, does not make mistakes, maybe that's better for their test team than Joss Butler is.
I will say that Joss Butler did take some spectacular catches in the third test. I agree that drops in test matches kill you more than they do in any other format of the game. But I think Joss Butler showcased that he does have that ability as a keeper, even though he did make some mistakes in the first test. I agree with you there. I think his batting spoke for itself, though.
Yeah, definitely. And then one more thing I'll say, Chinmay, even if you look at the third test, right, I don't think England ends up winning that anyways. But Joss Butler at the end of day four drops a sitter off of Jimmy Anderson.
I think everyone like, in the team dropped a sitter off Jimmy Anderson.
They did. But I'm going to give the other guys a little more, well, maybe not Stuart Broad. That one was directly at his chest, so complete lollipop. But since we're just on the topic of wicket keepers, it went straight into his gloves. He dropped that catch. You can argue if he takes that on day four, Pakistan is three down going into day five. It's a completely different match when they get those 40 overs. So, there's a lot of things to discuss around how important drop catches are. And yeah, it's not fair to speculate on every single one of them. But at the same time, a lot of these are regulation catches for test keepers.
In terms of the discussion about a specialty wicketkeeper, I feel like the last time we saw one like that from England was with Ben Foulkes. They gave him a few matches down in Sri Lanka. I can't even remember how long ago that was. But just looking at the England batting lineup, I don't know if there's space for us, but just a specialty wicketkeeper, especially if Ben Stokes is going to be out. I mean, Ollie Pope had a very subpar series as well, on a par with the openers compared to his previous series as well. But the only other place I could see that work for England is if they get Joss Butler to open.
I don't know if Joss Butler's suited to open in test matches.
Agreed. So basically, that's out of the question. Unless, or like Johnny Bairstow comes back and he wants to open.
Yeah, but I think those Butler and Bairstow are like, you have one of the two. One of the two, I feel like. I don't think they can have room for both of them in their lineup.
Yeah, why do you say that?
I think they're both decent keepers. I think they both are similar style of batting. I don't know if either of them are suited to opening. I would personally put them like in test matches, probably a number five, number six, a little bit middle order, and free up some specialist openers, top orders. And like going back to earlier, I think if Crawley pans out, then the top of their middle order with Crawley and, so let's say Crawley and Joe Root, it's kind of a solid start once they figure out their openers. I think they can again have that bad deep mentality that they had in the World Cup last summer. I know it was a different game.
Yeah, I think you made that leap for me. That's where I was going next. I was just about to say, Crawley, like I said, I'm on the hype train here, so I'm already writing him in as one of the best England batsmen that's going to play in the next 5 years. So if that pans out to be true, I think they have a lot of star power in their batting lineup. I think Stokes will eventually be back and take over that five spot. So there could be room for a true keeper if they have one. But, of course, Joss Butler is a staple in the English team, and you're never going to go wrong having him there.
I think the biggest benefit for England to have Joss Butler there late where he is that he can turn on his ODI game late if they need runs to put up runs quickly or to kind of seal a win if they need to. And I think that's one of the main reasons why they have him there. He hasn't had to do that really in the last couple series, but I think that's one of the reasons why Joss Butler is where he's at and where they wouldn't test him as an opener, because they don't have anybody else who can kind of play that role or who hasn't played that role as well as Joss Butler. So I think that's like a sneaky reason that they haven't had to rely on him for that yet. But if it comes down to that, that's just one more thing in Joss Butler's favor that no other keeper England has available to them would have at this point. One guy I want to highlight is Chris Wokes. The reason I want to highlight Chris Wokes is because you mentioned Stokes, who would come back and take over the five spot, and Stokes was out for personal reasons for the second and third test. And Wokes, in the first test, we saw him seal the win for England. And in the third test, we saw him add runs quickly, even though he's kind of more of a bowling all-rounder than a batting all-rounder. And I just want to make this point because I think it's important for teams around the world to look at. A guy like Chris Wokes, the batting and bowling contributions that he gives to you, and I know England, he gets overshadowed because they have Ben Stokes there to do that. But that's the type of player that's going to win you a tournament or a test match, right? Because everyone's going to have a star batsman. Everyone's going to have a star bowler. But it's these utility players that can chip in everywhere that are going to win you a match. And I think very few countries have those, and England happens to have like six. The contributions of Wokes highlight that for me as to where cricket as a whole is going. That you can't just have, you know, five specialist batsmen, four specialist bowlers, and then a couple of guys who can do everything. You need to have guys 1 through 11 who can do a little bit of everything. I know, you know, it's crazy to think like Joe Root isn't going to bowl consistently in all formats of the game. But Joe Root can bowl if he's called upon to do that, if England need a change. So just an example of a guy that we know him as a batsman, but he can also deliver with the ball if needed. So I think that was kind of Wokes' contributions kind of brought that to the forefront for me, where I think utility guys are going to be more and more important as cricket progresses.
Yeah, I agree. I think we've seen a lot of two all-rounder lineups now, right? Cricket, where you have two people who are, you know, could bat at the five position if they really needed to, and are also top-line bowlers, or one of your five bowlers. So, yeah, I definitely see the, you know, that barely used to happen. It, you know, before cricket, before the 2003 World Cup, if you were an all-rounder, that was like, oh, wow, this is it. The most unique thing that we've ever seen. You might have one of those on your team. Now, like you said, it's standard. You have to have two in order to be competitive. And we've seen just the, you know, the overall athleticism of cricket grow, and just the dynamic things that players are doing now, being able to hit 360, you know, different sorts of deliveries that they're able to pull off. It's changing a lot. We're seeing a lot of new dynamics in it. So yeah, it's definitely an all-rounders game now. And I think we're only going to see more all-rounders in the team, especially in tests.
Got to build that New Zealand team, too many all-rounders to include.
Well, it makes such a huge difference in tests because having bowling options is so paramount, especially when you're out there. If you need to fill up like 100 overs worth of bowling and people are tired, your frontline pacers are steaming in, and like they're going to be tired at the end of the day. And I mean, you saw in the England-Pakistan series, like Azhar Ali was tossing the ball to whoever could rotate their arm 180 degrees. And so, the more options, the better.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. We'll go to England's bowling now. And Stuart Broad and Jimmy Anderson both reached some significant milestones. Broad hitting 500 career test wickets, Anderson hitting 600 career test wickets. It took him quite a bit of time to get to that 600 and led to some frustration on his part and a lot of England fans. But I think it's crazy that we've seen two bowlers like this. I don't know if we've ever really seen it in our lifetime, kind of from start to finish, two bowlers paired up together to have these type of test careers. And you know, amazingly, they're still England's best options as frontline test bowlers, even at their advanced age. It's almost ridiculous to think about.
Yeah, they just have skills that no other bowler have. I mean, this is where experience really, really pays, and bowling in tandem is that they just define what that really means.
Is Jimmy Anderson an all-time great? Yes. But just because he's the only fast bowler to get 600 wickets, I don't think he's the best fast bowler, that we've seen. And I think I can name, top of my head, like five more, maybe?
I don't know if did anyone say that? I know I didn't.
So 600, so for a fast bowler, yeah, like insane longevity, don't get me wrong. He's in his 17th year, so he could definitely play till the Ashes next December, so a year and a half from now. He said he aims to. He said he aims to get 700. I don't think he will. But I would say he's a home bully, because his average in Asia, his average in Australia and South Africa, which is known for its bowler-friendly bouncy tracks, is nowhere near what is in swing-friendly green wickets in England. Stuart Broad, I think he's a great bowler, but he's not an all-time great. And I think that's more the case with him being a home track bully than even with Anderson. And I think, like, off the top of my head, just like Glenn McGraw, Courtney Walsh, Dale Steyn, he did everything Anderson did except 10 miles per hour faster. Better average, better strike rate. The only thing was, obviously, bowling that 10 miles per hour faster consistently will break his body down, and that's what happened.
I would say that about a lot of players, that they perform better at home than they do abroad.
but not with that much discrepancy.
But I can say that about a lot of players.
I don't know if it's that much of a discrepancy. So I'm looking at this right now. So at home, he's bowled 3,200 overs and taken 384 wickets. Away, he's bowled 2,400 overs and taken 216 wickets. So he's bowled 1.5 times more overs at home than he has away. And yeah, he's got significantly more wickets at home. He's got over 1.5, probably. Well, like look 1. At that
strike rate discrepancy. It goes from
23 to 32.
But I think this is the same thing as saying, look, I think this is the same thing as saying a guy racks up runs against Namibia, Zimbabwe, and the Netherlands, and we discount it as he's only scoring runs against those teams, right? Not I mean, you're basically making the same case that
not necessarily
to discredit Jimmy Anderson.
In a long career, even given that, you're still not going to play Namibia, Zimbabwe test match series as much as you play against Australia, if you're England, against Australia, against England, or sorry, against Australia, against India, against New Zealand, against the Caribbean, West Indies. So yeah, like they're gonna take the chances they get against Zimbabwe and Bangladesh and whoever, but you can't really hold that against them.
So why are you holding Jimmy Anderson performing slightly better at home?
It's not slightly better
abroad
I don't think he's slightly better at home. I think he's phenomenal at home, but his average falls off a lot when he goes abroad, especially in Asia.
Parth, go ahead.
All great players are not as good away as they are home. Like if we look at all of the greats, everyone is performing much better at home. So, yeah, I don't like that argument to not put him. I don't think he's the best of all time.
I don't think anyone has said he's the best of all time.
Right, yeah. He's definitely not as good away as he is home. The English conditions definitely fare him well. He's able to swing the ball. We all know what he does, right? He comes from an angle, brings the ball in a little bit, and gets the ball to move away. That's a stock delivery. And then, he's able to bring it in occasionally.
Sachin called that the double reverse, swinging it so late that even it would bamboozle him.
The other thing I would say, Shay, is just to speak to the longevity. I think that's extremely important in cricket. So Dale Steyn, unfortunately, a lot of injuries, but he fizzled out in a much shorter time than Jimmy Anderson does. It speaks a lot to a player to be able to be that consistent for that long, too. So I think that's a big part of having, being an all-time great. You have to play for a long time in order to be an all-time great in cricket. You have to be consistent over a long period of time. So I think he's better than Dale Steyn is what I'm saying as an all-time test bowler.
I think Dale Steyn's probably top two.
We can get into that on a different day.
All right, I got a question for you. As a duo, are Broad and Anderson better than Wasim and Waqar?
Oh, that is a good question.
No. Because I think, for me, I think Wasim is better than both of them.
Correct.
And I don't know what that gap looks like, because there was not that much overlap later in Waqar's career.
No, there wasn't.
With Wasim. So I think for me, I think it's Wasim Waqar, but mostly because Wasim Akram is probably, in my opinion, he is the best bowler ever.
Are they better than Ambrose and Walsh?
I haven't watched enough of Ambrose and Walsh to say that they're better.
Yeah, I don't think I could make that determination either.
All right. I just wanted to get some takes out there.
Yeah, but to Parth's point, it's widely said availability is the best ability.
100%. I'm not doubting that.
And longevity.
The most impressive part of his career is his longevity, because he's a fast bowler and, their bodies break down. He's doing... His average is getting slightly better as he's aging, which is like a feat that you should marvel upon. If anybody could get the 700, it's him. So wouldn't put it past him.
Yeah, and to have that not just with him, but with Stuart Broad as well.
Yeah,
to have that
tandem
for so long is something special. And I think they're definitely up there in terms of test bowling tandems. When you start mentioning great players and throwing, these all-time names around, yeah, we can poke holes in everybody. There's a statistical case to knock everybody down somewhere.
Sure.
You just have to find it. But I think they have done something tremendous, and it showed with these milestones. Switching sides now to Pakistan, and we've talked a lot about Pakistan's issues with consistency. We've said a lot that, one day Pakistan can be the best team in the world. and the next day they can lose to the worst team in the world. And I think this test series showed that, because in the first innings of the first test match, they looked incredible. Babar Azam was fantastic. Shaun Masood had that century to open things up. And then it kind of went all downhill from there until the rescue, semi-rescue job with the weather intervening in the third test match. But Pakistan's consistency was just not there after that first innings.
Yeah, it was really interesting in the series. I feel like Pakistan played their best in the only match that they lost. But yeah, still really frustrating overall. You know, they had individual contributions in a lot of their innings. Shaun Masood had a nice innings. Azhar Azmi had a nice innings. Mohammad Rizwan had a few nice innings. But again, in a test match, what it takes to win a big test match is putting together a big innings where multiple players contribute, and that's still something that Pakistan is struggling for. I feel like when we were discussing on our last podcast, how would Pakistan fare compared to West Indies, we had all said they'll pose a little bit more of a challenge, but still, in terms of getting the results, we would predict an England sweep. Now, of course, we had discussed the weather already, making a dent in that prediction. But, you know, a lot of it was same old Pakistan for me.
Yeah, it was interesting. I'll go back to what Chinmay said. The first match, I think they really deserved to win. I mean, if you take away Chris Wokes, who scored his highest score in test matches ever, his highest before this was 73, is 84 not out in 120 balls in that second innings. You take that away, or you take Joss Butler's 75 away, Pakistan should have won that match, and I think their bowling was just unable to take those last couple wickets at the end of that match. So, yeah, I agree with Anish that they definitely looked their best in the first match. Of course, nobody looked good in the rest of the matches because it just rained the whole time. But
the first match was actually, you could say it was almost Pakistan's. Like, I think they won the majority of the sessions there. And they,
yeah, they did.
They should have won that match, but I think it all comes down to experience again. Obviously, also rust after, you know, not playing test matches for 8 months. But yeah, I think it's fair to say, like, they'd be disappointed with that 1-0 result. They definitely should have taken that first match.
I don't know if you can just discount, you know, a Wokes innings or a Butler innings. I don't know. I don't really like playing that game of, like, you know, if you take one contribution away, because it's a match winning innings for a reason.
Yeah, yeah, I'll give it to Butler. I do still keep my point on Wokes, though, because he's really only had one score. I think he's only had one or two 50s, and he came up huge in this match after Pakistan was bowling extremely well to England's top order. So that's why I call that innings from him. Of course, I don't mean to take it away. It's a fantastic innings, and that's what Test cricket is all about. But definitely an anomaly innings, in my opinion, for Chris Wokes.
Sure, I agree with that. I think it's out there as an innings for him. But the performance just went downhill from there, even in that test match, right? Like, Pakistan played well in the first innings. Masood and Babar had fantastic scores, and they got above 300. And then they just completely blew it in the second innings with, like, what they scored, like 169, 170. So even in that first test, even when we're saying that Pakistan played so well in that first test match, and even we're saying they probably deserve to win that match, even in their second innings, they just laid a complete egg after a fantastic start with that first inning. So even in one match, you see kind of the flip-flopping for Pakistan. And I want to go to Babar Azam now for this, because obviously he played well in the third test to kind of secure their rescue job and get the draw. But there was some interesting commentary in the first test around Babar Azam. Nasser Hussain basically saying that, you know, if his name was Virat Kohli, we would be talking about him differently, but because his name is Babar Azam, no one's talking about him. And there should be a Fab Five. Everyone talks about a Fab Four, but there should be a Fab Five, and Babar Azam should be in that. I want to make this very clear. No one should really be compared to Virat Kohli in terms of pure numbers, because no one else is there. So the idea that someone is being talked about because they're Virat Kohli versus their Babar Azam is ridiculous, because there's a reason Virat Kohli is being talked about more, because he's arguably the best player in the world, and his track record has proven that over a long period of time. is Babar Azam one of the Fab Five? I don't even know if there really is a Fab Five. I think there's maybe two or three guys who are at the very top, but there's even gaps in between those guys. So this idea of a Fab Four, a Fab Five, I think we tend to highlight the top batsmen and we like to group them across, you know, different eras. We like to highlight all the guys that we can because we don't like to necessarily rank one over the other. But I think Babar Azam still has a long way to go to kind of solidify himself as one of the best batsmen in the world. He's done it more on the limited over side than in the test side. But I just think, you know, the idea of comparing him to Virat Kohli at this stage is still kind of crazy just because his record from a numbers standpoint hasn't really shown that. You can see the technique, you can see the talent, you can see the kind of trajectory where he becomes a guy like Virat Kohli, but he's not there yet. And I think that we need to kind of acknowledge that. And he's not in a Fab Four if we were to pick a Fab Four. Like, he's not in my top four if I was asked, give me the top four batsmen in cricket across all formats. Like, he's just not there. And that's not a knock on him, but the performances are not up to the level of those other four guys.
Who's your top four or top five then?
So I think if you had to give me a top four across all formats, it would be Virat Kohli, Steve Smith, Joe Root, and Kane Williamson. And that would be your, you know, the traditional Fab Four is what they'd be called.
So you're saying there's no Fab Five, and you're saying even
I don't even know if there's a Fab Four, to be honest.
Even in those four, there's gaps, which I agree with. I'm with you. I'm with you 100%.
Yeah, I agree too. And Chinmay, like you said, just based on the numbers, I mean, I'm putting Warner ahead of him as an all-around batsman too now. Yeah, I think really if we're going to compare it, I mean, Stokes has played more match-winning innings. And
Rohit too is a contender above.
Oh yeah, Rohit for sure. I was already going to include him. I think Rohit is better than probably two of the big four that we consider, at least right now.
Yeah, I would put Rohit top four above either.
Yeah. So, I mean, Babar Azam for me is struggling in the top seven right now off the top of my head. I don't know. I mean, he's struggling for top 10. So, yeah, I don't get that comment by Nasser. And, yeah, he's definitely not at that level yet, although he looks great when he bats, and I think he has a lot of potential, but he's not at that level yet. He needs to be producing a lot more consistently to be in that conversation.
I think speaking of consistent performers, though, I think Pakistan found a more consistent glove man than someone we've had the pleasure of watching over the years.
Yeah, we'll get to that right now. So Azhar Ali and Mohammad Rizwan in the third test, their partnership really rescued the match for Pakistan. And obviously the weather was a huge influence, but you have to take advantage of that. And you have to take advantage of how the chips fall, and Azhar Ali played a captain's innings and did the job, and Mohammad Rizwan supported him really well, and he looks to be a very significant upgrade over one Sarfaraz Ahmed, friend of the show, Sarfaraz Ahmed. and I think that partnership is a good sign for Pakistan going forward. Here are two sort of veteran guys taking the mantle and taking ownership. And it's something for these younger batsmen who have been plagued by consistency issues to look at and learn from. And I think that was a good learning experience for the rest of the Pakistani team. And obviously, massive contributions from the captain and the keeper.
So to segue from Pakistan taking out some friends of the show in the name of Sarfaraz Ahmed and Mohammad Hafeez, great, they listen to our advice, but they bring in a older and less experienced person by the name of Fawad Alam, and why? Like, why?
I'm glad you brought that up, Ashay.
Why did he have his first test in 12 years on a tour in England, which, you know, by all means, they had a shot. Like, no one was calling them favorites, but they had a shot at winning a test or even, you know, a test or two in the tour. Like, did they really not have younger talent that they could have brought on?
There is no excuse to bring in Fawad Alam for any international match, let alone a test match.
He hadn't played a test match in the last decade, so he literally hadn't.
Exactly. And I think, you know, he scored runs domestically, and even that can't be defended because he's not that young. he's not a young player, right? He's 34 years old. If he was a young player, it would at least make sense because he scored runs domestically and you're giving him a chance at the international level. But this just makes zero sense to me whatsoever. And it's a classic Pakistan selection. It is, yeah. let's go back and pluck a guy from some era who maybe performed well and has showed up again and resurfaced, and let's give him another chance. And this is why Pakistan continue to have consistency issues and continue to struggle in major tournaments, because they give guys too many chances. I mean, they're giving a guy who played a test match a decade ago, his last test match was over a decade ago, another shot in England against Broad and Anderson. I mean, there was just no way he was going to do well. There was just no expectation for him to do well. You couldn't have expected it. And shocker, he didn't do well.
You understand if Pakistan was playing a quote-unquote home game in the UAE and they have, like, you know, like a team, like, let's say the West Indies or Bangladesh or Ireland, Afghanistan touring them. Sure, sure. You can give Fawad Alam a chance, but
no,
like you said,
even then, no.
No.
You have a country of over 200 million people. You don't have a young domestic cricketer?
You're taking, like you said, exactly. If you want to set up a guy to succeed, or let's say you want to bring in, maybe you don't want to bring in a new guy who's 20, who's going to fail against Broad Anderson in cloudy, green conditions. Okay. But then you're just putting a guy further down, never going to pick him again after 5 tests and 0 50s to his name. Because, of course, the first chance he gets is, like you said, play against Broad Anderson and Archer on a green pitch. And, yeah, I don't know. I don't understand it.
Speaking of setting yourself up for success, it doesn't help to start in a discus-tossing stance before the ball is being bowled as well. So I'd like to point that one out. I don't know what that guy is doing, but I do not want to see him ever again. That was painful.
His body was his guard was on off stump, and he was literally facing the bowler when the ball was released.
I was even more disappointed that it was Shadab Khan that was dropped for this fool to be in the side.
Yeah, and Shadab Khan is a young, promising player.
But I get it.
And he showed some promise with the bat, too, right? It wasn't just the ball. So even, yeah, I mean, he showed promise on other sides of the field as well. So
yeah, this is, to me, I mean, I said it before, and, you know, I want to say, like, for Fawad Alam, like, I feel bad for the guy. Like, he got put in a position where, like, failure was the only route for him. There was no chance for him to succeed in these conditions. None whatsoever. So I feel bad for him as a player. He was put in a position to fail.
Imagine being Fawad Alam, okay? You've been racking up thousands of runs domestically, thousands of runs per season. Have your last test in 2008. Maybe, like, by 2012, you realize, oh, crap, I'm not going to get this call up. Forget about it. Surprise call in 2020. Hey, pack up for England. I don't understand. It literally just boggles the mind.
I don't think there's got to be
some misfa in that part of the decision for sure.
Oh, 100%. No, I think this is an operations issue for Pakistan. And it's not new, right? I mean, they've plucked guys out who have been, like, 5-6 years away from the game to put them back in. We talked about Mohammad Hafiz, Shoaib Malik playing into their late 30s, basically losing games for Pakistan, and they have refused to let younger players in.
Sahid Afridi also played till he was ineffective.
Yeah, pretty much. And now you have an opening, right? You have an opening. If they didn't want to play Shadab Khan, I don't know really why, but if they didn't want to play Shadab Khan, you're telling me that in a country of over 200 million people, you don't have a single young domestic cricketer who has potential? I mean, that's just a lie. You're just lying at that point. Because every country, like, even New Zealand has that. Even New Zealand with 5 million people have that. Right? Australia has that. Sri Lanka has that. The West Indies have that. I bet even Zimbabwe has that. All right? Like, that's just a lie. So I think this is one of those tired Pakistan tactics that they use, that they go back and they're like, oh, this guy's playing well. Oh, he played in a test match before. All right, let's bring him up and see what he does. And shocker, like, he didn't do well. And he's probably not going to play a test for Pakistan again. It's unfortunate for him.
You never know, man.
Actually, yeah, to be fair, you never know.
2023 might fall.
Yeah, you never know. So, I mean, they have to fix this. Like, they're not going to win a World Cup if they keep doing this. They're not going to win the World Test Championship if they keep doing this. They're probably not going to win the World Test Championship anyway because it's rigged, but we can save that for a different day. But they're not going to win a major tournament if they keep having a selection process like this. And I think Sarfraz Ahmed maybe was a start of it. Maybe we'll probably see Sarfraz Ahmed again. It's unlikely, but we'll probably see him again.
We'll definitely see him. We'll see Mohamed Hafeez. We'll see Sarfraz Ahmed. They'll probably try to coax Mohamed Asif out of retirement. To be fair, he's only like 28.
It just goes to show, in Pakistan, a cricketer is never truly canceled.
Nope.
There's three T20s now between England and Pakistan. Any chance Pakistan turns it around in the T20s, or is this all England in home conditions?
Yes, actually. I wouldn't be surprised if it was 1-1 going into the third T20. Pakistan has a shot, and then they clutch defeat from the jaws of victory in the third match.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think they're definitely, they're obviously, their best format is T20, so if there's any place to shine, it would be here. I do also think that they could probably steal a game here. Pakistan does perform well in T20s, and I think in these conditions, they will be able to put up a big score. Babar Azam has been playing extremely well in T20, so look for him to have at least one big innings in those three matches to help Pakistan secure a win. So I'm taking England 2-1 in that series.
Fawad Alam in the T20 roster or no?
Oh, please, no.
I don't think so. I think Babar Azam is worth half a game, and I think Pakistan's remaining 10 players will be worth the other half of a game. So, yeah, I'll give them one of the three T20s, and then I'll give Weather another one of the three T20s. So it'll be 1-1-1.
Right. Our best friend.
A three-way split between England, the Weather, and Pakistan before England's limited overs tour against Australia.
Yeah, you gotta look up the forecast anytime you're betting on a series.
We'll jump ahead now. Australia coming to England for three T20s and three ODIs before the IPL eligible players go join their squads in the UAE. A nice little limited over series here between the two World Cup semifinalists in that semifinal match. I want to see what England do against Australia, specifically in the ODI format, because I think that loss in particular really stung for Australia. I think that was easily their worst game in that World Cup, and it happened to come at a bad time for them, and I think they're out for blood. And I want to see how Warner, Smith, and the rest of the Australian batting lineup perform against England's bowlers. So I'm really looking forward to the ODI set, but I think that's going to be a really special limited over series, even if it's only six matches.
It'll just be great to see quality opposition facing each other, honestly. I think that's what I'm looking forward to the most.
That's going to do it for us here on the Follow On podcast. Check us out on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and as always, all of our content at followoncricket.com.